We do.
We do.
And we need your support.
Tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO's Slavic Community Hour is looking for new collective members. The Slavic Community Hour is an interactive news, talk, and music program focused on Portland's Ukrainian and Russian community. No experience is required, just an enthusiasm for Slavic culture and a desire to learn. If you speak Ukrainian or Russian and have an interest in community radio, please reach out to program@kboo.org to learn more. That's program@kboo.org.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Finance Committee meets the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify that a meeting is being held.
Tune in to KBOO Radio at 11 a.m. on the first Friday of every month for Understanding Homelessness with Dr. Marisa Zapata, a professor from Portland State University and director of the Homelessness Research and Action Collaborative. Each show will explore a different aspect of homelessness through the lens of people with lived experience, as well as other experts in research, policy, and programs.
This is Rising Up with Sonali, a weekly news and analysis program focused on economic, racial, gender justice, and more. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar, and you can find us online at risingupwithsonali.com. This week, we'll examine why Men's Central Jail in the LA County Jail System continues to operate and continues to house people in barbaric conditions. We'll speak with Mark Anthony Clayton Johnson, the Executive Director of Dignity and Power Now. Then we'll go to Iran, where historic protests were sparked by the custody death of a 22-year-old woman named Mahsa Amini. Hania Jodat, founding member of Women's March Los Angeles and co-host of Code Pink Congress, will be my guest. Finally, we'll turn to investigative journalist Sarah Posner to discuss her newest report on how Southern Baptists wove their ferociously misogynist and homophobic views into American politics. That's coming up in just a moment.
Thank you.
This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. For years, Los Angeles County Men's Central Jail has been plagued with problems. One of California's oldest jails, Men's Central, is part of the world's largest jail system, with an average daily population of about 22,000. The reports of violence against people being held at Men's Central are so disturbing, they've been dubbed barbaric. The County Board of Supervisors in Los Angeles, which has adopted a care first jails last approach at the insistence of activists, is now under fire for dragging its feet in closing down the jail and even reversing its position by considering a new jail facility for the mentally ill. My guest is Mark Anthony Clayton Johnson, Executive Director of Dignity and Power Now. Welcome to the program, Mark Anthony.
Thank you for having me, Sonali.
So for those of our audience, particularly outside LA County, give us a sense of the of what Men's Central Jail is and what it has represented, particularly for families in Los Angeles. It's a notorious facility, and it's in downtown LA, you know, the place that people associate with the LA skyline and, you know, the business district and the arts district. And here we have Men's Central Jail. So give us, how do you explain it for, say, someone in Seattle or New York?
For sure. I mean, I think what's important to note in terms of understanding the scale of the problem, Los Angeles has the largest jail system in the world. On any given day, we historically have had up to 20,000 people in our jail system. As of today, we have somewhere between 14 and 15,000 folks. And Men's Central Jail is the largest facility in our jail system. It's also important to know that the Los Angeles County Jail System is home to the largest mental health facility in the country, Twin Towers Jail, which is built on the premise that a state-of-the-art medical facility could function as a jail and could improve well-being for people who are incarcerated. And we've only seen that myth fail. And we have seen it time and time again. And Men's Central Jail also sits within the center of that, because it is the place where people who have very serious medical needs are held. It is a site of so much historic violence. And we have moved, and when I say we, I mean community members, people who've been incarcerated in those jails, people who have lost loved ones to brutality and medical abuse and negligence in those jails, have actually moved the Board of Supervisors to close it, to say, look, we are ready to say we are going to close Men's Central Jail and not build anything else. And what has been disheartening is that there is a map, there is a solution, there is a well-researched, well-substantiated plan, and we have yet to see the Board of Supervisors really invest in that plan that would improve the well-being of our communities and see less and less jail facilities in Los Angeles County.
Let's get a sense of the brutality, because that makes the strongest case for why Men's Central should be closed. Tell me about Jelani Lovett, a young man who lost his life and one of many who've lost their lives in Men's Central.
You know, Jelani is one of 55 people who died in the Los Angeles County Jail system last year. That is more people that have died in a single year in a decade. What's unfortunate about it is that we have lost another loved one, another young Black man, and his mother, Terry Lovett, is constantly fighting for justice, calling on the Attorney General, Rob Bonta, to investigate the Sheriff's Department. But what is also really disheartening and frustrating is that the families have to deal with lack of transparency, have to deal with justifications that don't make sense. And so when Terry Lovett, Jelani's mother, is told that her son was found unresponsive with fentanyl in his system, even though he was in solitary confinement, one has to ask, how did he get the fentanyl? When Terry receives an autopsy report that shows that his shoulder was pulled out of his socket, that he had bruising on his body, that showed he had injuries, organ damage, that doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up to say that fentanyl or suicide was the cause of death. And yet this is the pattern. in which Black and Brown mothers are finding their children dead in the county jails with no answers, with cover-ups. In fact, we have published a report that showed that a lot of people, particularly Black folks, but not limited to that, are finding that the medical coroner's office are ruling the deaths of people in the jails as natural, which should raise questions for all of us, because most people who are being given a designation of natural death in our society are in their end of life stages. We're talking about 70, 75 years old. In the county jails, it's less than 50 years old. People have evidence of brutality on their bodies. People have evidence of medical negligence and abuse. And so anytime anybody dies, including Jelani, in the county jail system, it should raise serious alarm around the questions of sheriff misconduct, brutality, and abuse.
So you have a situation where a person was not, you know, one of dozens killed within this jail system. And as we mentioned, this is the largest jail system in the world. And the who oversees this jail system is, of course, the sheriff, an elected position. For years, L.A. County Sheriff Lee Baca had, you know, basically been under fire for overseeing this jail system. And then a few years ago, there was thought to be a new-ish chapter, I suppose, for the reformists, who thought replacing Lee Baca with Alex Villanueva, who is the new sheriff, would improve things. What has happened under Villanueva's leadership?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important for folks to understand and for your listeners to understand that in Los Angeles County, we have seen three sheriffs over the last decade repeat very similar patterns. So we're talking about Baca, McDonald, and Villanueva.
That's right. I didn't mention McDonald, yeah.
And while the method may be different, how they show up in public may be different, their political savviness may be different, but the outcomes are very similar. Cover-ups, abuses, violence against our loved ones, rogue deputy gangs that hunt our loved ones, that actually initiate members into their gangs via the ritual of harming people up to the point of death, of killing people in our communities and in our neighborhoods. And so what we've seen by Villanueva is really giving deputy gangs free rein, unchecked, unaccountable rein to continue that type of behavior. We've seen the Civilian Oversight Commission that we won that has called deputies and sheriff's staff in by subpoena to testify around the existence of deputy gangs that have confirmed it. They have confirmed themselves that even employees of the sheriff's department have been harassed by deputy gangs. And yet Sheriff Villanueva and some of his higher ups will not show, will defy subpoenas, will defy testifying under oath to face any of the questions that families have been raising about the level of violence and brutality that exists, not just in the community, again, but also in the jails. We know that, again, Jelani was killed in the jails on the 3000 floor, and the historic 3000 Boys is just one of many deputy gangs that exist in this jail system. And it's one of the reasons why we cannot accept, certainly not building a mental health jail, but also understanding that people with mental health disabilities are very high likelihood to experience the type of brutality and medical abuse and negligence that is causing people their lives.
And then we had most recently this high profile incident where one of the County Board of Supervisors, Sheila Kuhl, had her home searched under a warrant from the sheriff's office. She has been one of the sheriff's critics on the County Board of Supervisors. It is thought that this might have been some sort of retaliation and, you know, just sort of taking on this kind of aspect that makes it seem like we're watching a bizarre television show about about what happens in the LA County jail system and its political critics. As far as I know, Villanueva has denied that this was political retaliation. But tell me about some of the county board politics around closing Men's Central and in general the accountability around the jail system. And, you know, there are elections coming up very soon.
Certainly. And yes, what you are seeing and what you're talking about is an example of a sheriff who will use any and all tactics at his disposal to try and intimidate elected officials, intimidate people who criticize him, intimidate journalists, and certainly intimidate family members who have lost loved ones and people who criticize him. The behavior is consistent across the board. And so, you know, the Board of Supervisors has been clear that Men's Central Jail needs to close. And certainly that is not up for debate. And what we also know is the elections come up that everyone across LA County will have the opportunity to vote on Measure A and to determine for themselves whether the Board of Supervisors should have the ability to remove a sheriff for cause if within the four-year term of a sheriff, they have demonstrated that they cannot do the job, that they are making conditions worse. And so these things are moving and community members are advancing solutions. And what is happening right now is we have a debate in the county. Amidst all this, we should be able to just focus on the solutions that have already been determined to work. But now we have a debate in the county around what to do with the mental health population in the jails. And the sheriff has been a recalcitrant and unhelpful force at best when talking about people with mental health disabilities, talking about them as violent and irredeemable. We know the opposite is true. When we provide spaces of care for people, when we provide a clinical workforce, when we provide wraparound services to folks, judges, the DA, public defenders, clinicians, and certainly community members agree that that is the safest solution for people who even have the most serious mental health diagnoses and violent charges. We have seen really strong evidence for the success of these type of programs. And that's what we built the Care First, Jail Last roadmap on. And that's what we are challenging the board to invest millions of dollars in making a reality.
And yet there's consideration of a mental health jail facility. I mean, it just is bizarre how there was a time when jailing people, imprisoning them or putting them into an incarcerated position, even though it's a jail, is, you know, while they experienced mental health problems, was too cruel for society. We would not want to institutionalize people against their will, but it's essentially, it sounds like this is what the County Board of Supervisors is potentially considering?
Correct. And so what we have is a situation where the Board of Supervisors is now debating between a couple options. One, and it's important to talk about the underlying premise. The underlying premise in either one of the options that I'm going to explain to you is that there are certain people in the jails who, because of how severe their mental health crisis is and because of their charges, they cannot benefit from diversion. They cannot benefit from programs that would get them out of the jail, out of a cell, into the community, into peer-based models with clinicians on site and resources on site and permanent housing, even though we know that that model works. However, the sheriff has been successful in creating a narrative, and Supervisor Barger has been successful in creating a narrative that there are just certain people that can't be diverted. And so there's a debate happening around whether we should build locked mental health facilities that very much function like jails, or we build facilities that are secure enough for people to be there, but get the treatment that they need and step down into other types of facilities in which they can have the type of care and community-based treatment that they deserve. And what I mean by that is many of us have had to take a loved one to a hospital when they're in the midst of psychosis, when they're in the midst of hearing voices or believing that they're in danger, maybe experiencing paranoia. And that can be a very stressful and uncertain experience. And you want to know that if you take that person to the hospital or you take them to a treatment center, that you're not going to get a call that your loved one somehow ran out of the treatment center and ran into ongoing traffic and got hurt, or got into an interaction with a police officer and got killed, right? And so many of us understand the need for secure spaces, but that is very different than locked mental health jails. It is very different than treatment-oriented facilities. It is very different than seeing someone as a patient rather than assuming that because of their charges, that is just the nature of who they are. The other thing you should know is that when either one of these motions that have been put before the board were put forth, they were based in this idea that the severity of people's crisis was the reason they cannot be diverted. But in fact, the severity of people's crisis is temporary. Right. And so right now, in any given moment, you have over 1,000 people in our jail system right now who are so severely in their mental health episode that they need really concentrated treatment and that clinicians have designated them as unable to be diverted in this moment. But the problem with that is that's temporary. The problem is that we don't have enough resources to get in there and get folks stabilized, which could take 72 hours for some people. It could take a week. It could take a month, right? But the point is it's temporary. And so to assume we need to build locked jail-like treatment facilities based on a very temporary phase in someone's care is a fundamentally flawed and inhumane analysis,
right,
because that we're challenging the board to reject.
We're talking about a jail system, not a prison system. A jail system is where one is held while awaiting trial. It's where one is held after arrest and before trial. And so these are all presumed innocent people. Before
Correct.
They can be seen as guilty or pronounced guilty, they have to be presumed innocent. That's a constitutional right. So this is a jail system. And so any number of people at any given time within that jail system are likely innocent of any crime, but are being held in horrific conditions. I want to get to, because we're running out of time, I want to get to this, the question of some of the reports coming out just from the booking centers at Men's Central and the LA County Jail system, where people are being shackled, unable to use the restroom facilities, so literally like sitting in their own filth and, you know, sleep, having to sleep for days. Tell me about this aspect of the story that, you know, in and of itself should be reason enough to shut down the facility.
It should be, and it is a very serious human rights crisis. It is a crisis that is very much out of compliance with federal mandates for how the board and how the county should be operating the jails.
Right, the jail system is under federal oversight.
Exactly. And so, yes, what you're seeing is episodes throughout the year that keep happening where there is tremendous backup and overcrowding in the reception center, and people are being held shackled, as you said, to benches while they're in the severity of their crisis, their mental health crisis, and are kept in these places while they're trying to find a bed for these people. And it is quite disturbing to see. It has gotten so bad that the ACLU has issued a temporary restraining order, has appealed to a judge to say, hey, look, you can't keep people shackled to a bench for more than 4 hours, and you certainly can't keep people here in this space overnight. When there's no beds, there's no mattresses, there's no anything for people to sleep on. They're literally sleeping on concrete while suffering and dealing with their mental health crises. And so that is what continues to happen. And that happens because of the broader lack of systemic care capacity in the community. And the reality is we have seen the board time and time again. Just 2 months ago, we saw Supervisor Mitchell put forward a motion that said, hey, look, let's put millions of dollars into expanding the type of community-based treatment that we know works for one of the most difficult populations, people who have mental health disabilities and people who have violent charges. And that motion was voted down and watered down by Supervisor Solis, by Supervisor Kuhl. And so we see this constant undermining of
And Kuhl are supposed to be the liberals on the board.
Correct. Solis did was one of the champions for canceling the $3.5 billion jail plan back in 2019. She knows this is a problem. But just because you have a, quote, liberal or progressive board doesn't mean they can all coordinate around progress. And that is the dilemma that we're in, and it's costing us lives.
Thank you so much, Mark Anthony, for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
My guest has been Mark Anthony Clayton Johnson, the Executive Director of Dignity and Power Now. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. A 22-year-old Iranian woman named Mahsa Amini died in police custody in mid-September, sparking mass historic protests across Iran. Amini was jailed for reportedly flouting Iran's strict dress code for women. Now, as hundreds of thousands of people protest across the country, Iran's government is facing a crisis of legitimacy. My guest is Hania Jodat, an Iranian-American activist, former co-political director for Senator Nina Turner, organizer with Roots Action, founding member of Women's March Los Angeles, and co-host of Code Pink Congress. Welcome to the program, Hania.
Thank you for having me, Sonali.
So first, tell us who Mahsa Amini was. I understand she was a member of Iran's Kurdish minority?
Absolutely. She was a Jina, Mahsa Amini. Jina is her Kurdish name. She was a 22-year-old young woman who died in the custody of the morality police on September 16th.
She, I understand, was arrested for not adhering properly to Iran's dress code for women. She supposedly wasn't wearing her scarf correctly. Explain why she was arrested and what happened, as far as we know, what happened to her under custody.
Sure. So hijab became mandatory, and the current strict dress code became mandatory after the 1979 revolution. And as a result of that, you have the morality police now that under different presidents acts differently. Under some presidents, they are more lenient. Under Raisi's current regime, they are more strict on young women showing their hair. And so in the case of Jina, she was arrested, was taken into custody. Some reports say that she collapsed at the detention center after spending a few days in custody. And the reports from the UN show that she was beaten by the authorities. However, the Iranian officials have said that she died as a result of a heart attack. There is an ongoing investigation. The UN human rights experts have asked for an independent, impartial investigation into her death, but it remains to be seen whether the government of Iran is going to comply with these requests or not.
So who is protesting? Who is it that is, you know, on the streets of Tehran and other cities in Iran right now?
Yeah. So the the Karan movement in Iran, even though it is led by young Iranian women protesting these compulsory hijab laws, is very inclusive because at the core of it lies the issue of women's rights and their demand for equity and equality, whether that's through equitable education, quality work, getting paid equally as men and as their counterparts do. From the images that we see out of Iran, there are men and women, young and old, protesting together, women who wear the hijab by choice, and those who have been burning their hijabs and cutting their hair in showing resistance to the current government and these laws. They're standing shoulder to shoulder. Students also happen to be at the core of this movement for the very first time. Several professors at the very prestigious Sharif University of Technology in Tehran went on strike demanding that the detainees who are students be released. But this movement is very inclusive at the core, because at the core of it lies the woman's rights to choose what she wishes to do with her body.
So it was sparked by the death of this young woman, but the protests, and as is the case often with protests like this, where you have this sort of like straw that breaks the camel's back, the protests are about that incident as symbolic of a lot more. And even of the economy and the state of the economy, which is a big issue, but also women's participation in the economy?
There's a lot to unpack here. I think for the past 6 years, six plus years, as a result of Trump's unilateral sanctions, Iranian civic society has been crippled. We have over 40% inflation in Iran right now. Our tuman is worth absolutely nothing internationally anymore. So the pressure that has been put on, especially our women's rights activists in Iran, who have to now hold 4 to 5 different jobs to put food on their table and feed their children, the pressure has mounted to now resulting in these protests, right? So yes, economy has a lot to do with it. These restrict laws, and the repression from the regime of Iran have a great deal to do with it. But I think what we see again at the core of the protest is 40 plus years of laws that have repressed women. And again, whether you are in the streets of Tehran protesting right now, or here in the suburbs of the US, the parallel that can be drawn here is that women want equity, equality, and they wish to choose what is right for their body in their own terms, right?
So when we think about the protests in Iran today, they're being dubbed as historic, but there've been similar chapters of mass protests ongoing every few years, it seems, right? I mean, we shouldn't see what's happening in Iran right now as isolation, as if it's just happening. There's a strong tradition of protest in Iran. There's been strong movements in Iran. They've been repressed, of course. And then every now and then, things sort of burst open. How does what's happening right now compare with earlier chapters of Iran's protest, which have also sometimes been sparked by, you know, the death of a young woman?
Well, in 2009, with the Green Revolution, obviously, the Iranians were uprising against voter suppression. They wanted a democratic movement that was called the Green Movement. Again, they were asking for better jobs, better opportunities in life, a chance to thrive, right? This time it's a bit different because, again, you have women and you have young women, whether they choose again to wear the hijab or they choose to burn their scarves, coming together saying enough is enough. And I think what makes this very historic is that you're for the very first time hearing from a community that's minority in Iran that is very oppressed, right? And that's what makes it very special, I think, to the international audience, as well as really just fueling the fire in Iran. Our young women are some of the most resilient women I have ever seen. So they are the voices of this courageous movement. And so that's why it's, you know.
Yeah, if this movement is different, if this protest chapter is different, what is the potential for there to be a change in the government in Iran?
Well, the change that the Iranian people inside of Iran wish to see is really incumbent upon whether they continue to stay in the streets or not. Time and time again, we've seen that the government has used tactics and ways to quiet the protesters, whether it's through jailing some of the critical thinkers behind these protests or detaining students, cutting off the internet and social media, so that the movement is now, you know, quietly being suppressed. I think if they continue to do this and continue to remain in the streets, I think we will see some changes. But that, again, is really dependent on whether what the government does.
And has the government also been organizing its own a counter to the protesters? In the past, we know that there have been rallies and marches that the government has organized by its own supporters to counteract, at least visually, what we see in the streets with actual protesters.
Sure. I mean, they have responded in large numbers. There are protests against the protesters from the more conservative folks who support the government of Iran. Unfortunately, more than ever, there has been a major crackdown on Iranian internet and as well as social media, and the Basij has been using different tactics to silence the protesters. Hundreds have been wounded. There has been many clashes with the police and the parliamentary forces. So there are two sides to this story that are protesting each other as well.
And the internet crackdown in particular is also really interesting, because when you have that, you have to have the cooperation often of international companies. Has there been any solidarity outside of Iran to help Iranians inside access the internet, have digital access?
There has been solidarity, although I say this cautiously, because any democracy, and I mean the United States of America, that places sanctions on a population of 80 million plus, does it really stand in solidarity with the Iranian movement, right? I was very cautious about that. Of course, Biden responded. Senior Biden officials have also denounced the government's crackdown on the movement. The U.S., in response to the crackdowns, has imposed more sanctions on the morality police, in addition to sanctioning some of the Iranian officials, senior officials. The Treasury Department modified the U.S. Sanctions to let technology companies counter the Iranian government's internet crackdown and surveillance. So yes, there is solidarity coming, but I also feel like, you know, how can you show solidarity with a community that you've sanctioned and starved for the past right. 6 years plus, right?
And Iranians are as active as they can be digitally. There was I understand a TikTok star, a person who had a lot of followers on TikTok, a 20-year-old woman who earlier this week was shot dead while participating in protests. And there have been several people killed in the protests themselves, right? And so we're seeing the harsh crackdown, which I imagine is just extremely scary, especially for those women who are taking the active step of cutting off their hair in public, removing their headscarves in public. This is a very risky thing to do, right?
Certainly, absolutely. And one thing that I really do urge for everyone to do is to really listen to the voices coming out of Iran. Unfortunately, during times like these, you have the conservative Republican arm of the Iranian community that lives outside of the country, right, promoting their own agenda. So it's very important for us as the viewers, as folks who are outside of the country, to really listen to the cries of Iranian women who live inside under a repressive regime. What I would do is I would urge for my sisters in Iran to continue protesting. And they should know that we fully support them. So
you still have family in Iran?
I do. My mother lives there, my auntie lives there, and I do have extended family on my father's side. whom I've not been able to get in contact with actually for the past few days. So
as far as you know, or what can you tell us about what you're hearing from family members, from friends that you might still have in Iran, about how they're facing these, or participating potentially in the protests, or how they view what's happening? Anything that you can give us from inside Iran, a glimpse into the mindset of the ordinary Iranian?
Right. Well, of course, because of the internet crackdowns, I have not been able to get in contact with anyone from inside the country. I've tried on a number of occasions to call my mother. WhatsApp is the means where we speak and see each other, but she has not been able to receive any of my messages. And I've tried to get in contact with some of my closer friends there, and the messages are not delivered. So the only way she was able to connect with me was via email once on Saturday, just to tell me that she's okay and she's doing well. So it's really hard to say without being able to communicate with family members, but I would assume that there is happiness and sadness. There is frustration and anger. My mother, who grew up during the time of Shah and saw the revolution and what happened after the revolution, who's a woman who wants a democratic Iran, is sad and happy probably at the same time. Sad because there are so many brave young women and men out there right now protesting, but happy that there is a movement happening and taking shape inside the country, right? That can lead towards a more free, equitable society in Iran, free of church and state per se, right?
Hania, thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck to you and good luck to your family.
Thank you so much.
My guest is Iranian-American Hania Jodat, former co-political director for Senator Nina Turner, organizer with Roots Action, founding member of Women's March Los Angeles, and co-host of Code Pink Congress. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. The U.S.'s largest Protestant denomination, Southern Baptists, have had a good year with the Supreme Court's overturning of the Roe v. Wade abortion precedent. How Southern Baptists came to be involved in conservative politics to wield a virulently misogynist and homophobic agenda is a fascinating story, one that my guest Sarah Posner tells in her new investigation for The Nation. Sarah Posner is a reporting fellow with Type Investigations. Her extensive reporting and analysis on the religious right in Republican politics has appeared in The Nation, The New York Times, The Washington Post, The American Prospect, Rolling Stone, The New Republic, and many other publications. Her latest piece in The Nation is entitled "The Southern Baptist Convention's Deal with the Devil." Welcome to the program, Sarah.
Thanks for having me, Sonali.
So for those of us who just are ignorant about the constellation of Protestant denominations in the United States, give us a sense of where Southern Baptists fit in. I mentioned they are the largest denomination.
They're the largest Protestant denomination, which also makes them the largest evangelical denomination. And as such, they really kind of set the tone and the theology for a lot of other evangelicals who don't necessarily belong to a denominational church.
And when we hear the term Southern Baptist, does that mean that they're mostly located in the southern states?
No, they're located all over the country, but their roots are in the South. and the denomination was formed as a result of a split over slavery in which the Southern Baptist Convention was in favor of it.
Where have Southern Baptists historically stood on things like reproductive rights? And how do you view, or how do you explain their position today, where they have basically given had their agenda on ending abortion really become synonymous with the Republican Party's agenda? What's the historical tracing there?
Well, in the late 1970s, there were a group of far-right figures within the denomination who set out to engage in what they called a conservative resurgence within the denomination. The critics of it, the moderates and liberals who were forced out of the denomination as a result of the conservative resurgence, called it the fundamentalist takeover. But basically what happened was there was a concerted effort to install far-right leaders in positions of power within the denomination and within the denomination's many seminaries. And that effort was successful and coincided with the marriage of the religious right with the Republican Party. So by the time that Ronald Reagan ran for his first presidential term in 1980, the religious right had coalesced around the Republican Party, and the conservative resurgence brand of the Southern Baptist Convention was right at the center of that. And as soon as that happened, they started radicalizing their position on abortion. So that, you know, going from the late 1970s or early 1980s, where it was they were in favor of it if the health or life of the mother was in danger in cases of incest or rape, they progressed from there to wanting it banned outright to stating that they considered it to be a genocide.
This is a denomination that's not, they're not literalist, right, in terms of the Bible. I mean, it's sometimes hard to keep track of the many positions and the many denominations and the positions that they take. So where does Southern Baptist fit on interpreting the Bible? Because, you know, we have this image of, well, the anti-gay evangelical who quotes passages from the Bible, or the misogynist churchgoer who thinks women belong in a particular place, but in quote from the Bible. Where does Southern Baptist stand on that, or do they have a modern interpretation?
The what they call the inerrancy of the Bible, or the literalism of the Bible, was what was at issue in the conservative resurgence. So the architects of the conservative resurgence contended that the problem that the denomination was having was that there were people within it who did not believe that the Bible, as they read it, was 100% true. And that's what led to the firing and the marginalizing of seminarians and pastors who disagreed with that view. So it was their contention that they were protecting the 100% literally true aspect of the Bible that led to their extreme positions on abortion and LGBTQ rights, because they believe that that is the literal interpretation of the Bible. And not inconsequentially, their views on gender roles are also informed by this supposed literal interpretation of the Bible, meaning that they adhere to a theology that says that a wife must be submissive to her husband and that he is the head of the household.
Is this something that is just unsaid and taken for granted, or do they spell it out, the position of the wife in the household?
They spell it out. They actually amended their faith message in the 1980s to more explicitly spell that out. And one of the contentious issues within the denomination right now is whether, you know, a small minority of people within the denomination believe that women should be allowed to be preachers, for example. But the position of the denomination is that no, women should not be allowed to be preachers, nor should they ever teach from the pulpit. So the regressive views on women and their roles both in the family and within the church remain very intensely baked into their theology and their politics. And even though there are people who have left the denomination over these views, they remain like Jimmy Carter, for example, former President Jimmy Carter is a very well-known example of that. But these views remain very entrenched in the denomination.
Tell me about Paul Pressler, one of the leading figures who helped push the church into a more conservative direction starting in the 1980s.
So Pressler was not a pastor or a theologian or a seminarian. He was a state court judge in Texas. And he was a Southern Baptist layman who was good friends with Paige Patterson, who was a very prominent and influential theologian. And they were the architects of the conservative takeover. They sort of planned this way that they would take over they would seize control of the election process at the annual meeting so that they could ensure that their conservative choices were picked for leadership positions within the denomination and its seminaries. And he was a really throughout the 1980s and 90s and even into the 2000s, he was a very important, influential figure, not only for Southern Baptists, but for evangelicals and for the Republican Party and the religious right as a whole. George H.W. Bush had nominated him for a government post during his term as president. But then in 2017, Pressler became the subject of a lawsuit by a man who charged that he had basically groomed him and raped him repeatedly over a multi-decade period after meeting him in a Bible study that Pressler frequently conducted for teenage boys and men. And additional men came forward in the course of that lawsuit, and Pressler is now not only a leading figure still in the, you know, known historically as a leading figure in the conservative resurgence, but he is also an important figure in the sex abuse scandal that is engulfing the denomination at the moment.
And that's a really important part of this, because the flip side of the pushing of misogynist, patriarchal, homophobic politics through the Republican Party is that this denomination has very prominent figures who are themselves guilty of some of the very things that they accuse their opponents of. And that hypocrisy is, of course, sort of screaming out to be told.
Right. Now, just to be clear, Pressler has denied the sex assault allegations against him. But the lawsuit, the civil lawsuit that was brought against him, it, you know, proceeds. So, you know, that remains to be sorted out in the courts. But he is not the only figure, leadership figure in the denomination who has been identified both by reporting, particularly by the Houston Chronicle and the San Antonio Express News, who together conducted a groundbreaking investigation of sex abuse in the Southern Baptist Convention that came out in 2019 and had prompted the Southern Baptist Convention to hire its own outside consulting firm to investigate sex abuse within the denomination. And what all of that reporting found was that sex abuse was very widespread within the denomination, and that covering it up at the highest levels was done, you know, with impunity, so that people who had been victimized by pastors or other church employees never got accountability. They were vilified for even coming forward, and the denomination moved people around. If they were, you know, accused of sex abuse in one church, they knew about it, but they moved them around to another church. And they even kept a secret database of sex offenders in their churches at their headquarters, but they never made it public. So these were some of the really explosive allegations coming out of that report. And now the denomination is under investigation by the Department of Justice. So this there's still a lot that needs to be uncovered and exposed, but all of this was happening alongside the Southern Baptist Convention's involvement in politics and pressing of these patriarchal and misogynist and homophobic political agendas.
What about the leader today, president of the denomination, Albert Mohler Jr., who you also write about? You open your story with him. Who is he and how responsible is he, not only for any potential cover-ups of the sordid deeds within the denomination, but also pushing the misogynist homophobic agenda?
So Mohler is the president of the denomination's flagship seminary. So he's not the president of the denomination itself. The members of the denomination who attend the annual meeting, they elect the president, and they elected a new president this year. But Mohler is probably a more influential figure than almost any of the other presidents of the denomination have been, because of his status as a leading theologian and his status as the president of Southern Seminary, which is, like I said, their flagship seminary. He's a prolific writer. He has a podcast and radio show. He speaks very frequently at conservative conferences. So he's a very key figure in shaping Southern Baptist views of both their theology in the Bible and of politics. So I don't know that he had a role in the cover-up of the sex abuse, but he has definitely played a key role, like I said, in shaping Southern Baptist views of political issues, particularly abortion. For example, at the most recent convention, which took place this spring in Anaheim, California, he endorsed, you know, the criminal prosecution of women who seek abortions.
Okay, that is a really important point to focus on. So banning abortion via the Supreme Court, and now, of course, state by state, the rights are falling in particularly states led by Republicans. Banning abortion was step one, is prosecuting women who have abortions, maybe in the future miscarriages. Is that the next? Is that what's next on the Baptist, Southern Baptist Convention's radar?
Well, I think that Mohler was speaking at the annual meeting, which took place between the time that the Dobbs opinion leaked from the Supreme Court and we had the actual opinion come out at the in June. So he was speaking sort of in the time period between those two occurrences, but he was thrilled with the leaked opinion, which was, you know, basically identical to the actual one. And so he was asked by somebody in a Q&A session, well, you know, so what does this mean? Do you think not just, you know, doctors could be prosecuted, but women too? And he allowed that, you know, miscarriages might be a different kind of circumstance, but he did indicate that prosecuting women who seek abortions should be something that the legal authorities should pursue. And, you know, he went on to praise the actual final Dobbs opinion and pointed to it as evidence that there had been a resurgent conservative majority on the Supreme Court. So it was almost like he was thinking of the stacking of the Supreme Court with right-wing justices as being somewhat analogous to the conservative resurgence in his own denomination, and that, you know, these kinds of conservative takeovers of institutions are a good thing.
Has the misogynist approach, this idea that you know, women's bodies need to be controlled, they need to be submissive to their husbands, has that tended to go hand in hand with homophobic attitudes, with the anti-gay tirades, anti-trans approaches? Are those intertwined?
Yes, they're completely intertwined, because it's all based on a theology that at its core says that God ordained men and women and certain gender roles for men and women. And so any deviation from that, say if you're a man who's gay or you're trans, that's considered a deviation from these God ordained gender roles and God's plan for the family, God's design, they call it sometimes God's design for men and women, or biblical manhood and biblical womanhood. These are the phrases that they would use to describe it. So obviously that plays into their views on LGBTQ rights and women's rights, even beyond abortion rights. But abortion rights obviously has been the target of their public policy and legal agenda.
Sarah, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I could keep talking to you, but there's so much to discuss. People can certainly find your article in the latest issue of The Nation, and we'll post a link to it from our website as well. Good luck to you, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
My guest has been Sarah Posner, who is an investigative journalist and a reporting fellow with Type Investigations. She's done extensive reporting and analysis on the religious right in Republican politics. Her latest article in The Nation is called "The Southern Baptist Convention's Deal with the Devil." I'm Sonali Kohatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Kits Up. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on Twitter.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The following program is a rebroadcast. For all of KBOO's archived audio, please visit our website at kboo.fm.
90.7 KBOO Portland.
Quiero mucho.